Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, comrades, compañeros, fifth columnists, welcome to another edition of the paid version of this podcast, the members only. We have been more silent than normal. I mean, we've had a lot to do. I mean, technically, you got a couple of episodes last week because of the Megyn Kelly appearance, but, you know, herding cats. It has been a below average week and a half. So we apologize for that. So what did I do rather than, you know, record a new one, which we're going to do, I think, in the next 2 days? We're recording an episode tomorrow on Wednesday, April 3rd. And that will be with our friend Andrew Sullivan, a multi-time guest and always fun and funny to have on. And then we'll be doing another one for you subscribers. But this is an almost lost episode. So we do the second Sunday, which is a live recording with you subscribers. You can hop on the Zoom, call us, talk to us, and we answer your questions. We did that on the second Sunday of last month, but because of a particular host of this show, I'm not going to tell you who. I mean, it's not fair to tell you that it's Camille, but a particular host of the show who didn't show up, didn't give me privileges to record the damn thing. So we had recordings on my end and Matt's end, but not of the questions from a few of you people. So, you know, it was kind of hard to stitch back together, but we did so. And you'll hear us answering questions, but you won't hear the questions. There's only a few of them. You get the point. The other thing I have to apologize for is because when I was re-listening to this, I started off, maybe had a few libations towards the end of this. I think I'm getting a little shaky, but it's, you know, I listened to it. I said, God, Lord, do I have to put this out? But at the end of it, I do talk at some length about something I don't talk a ton about. It did come up naturally, which was my experience in the Jonah Lehrer story, which, you know, I've told before and I get bored by it and I don't mention it very much. But it came up and I talked about the process of revealing those lies and the effect it had on everyone, actually. So just excuse the fact that I'm, you know, maybe seven drinks in at this point. So, and the reason I released this is because you're subscribers. And, you know, I feel bad that we didn't do anything last week. We very rarely do that. So if you're a new subscriber and you're like, what is going on? It's a rare one. We apologize. And I'm going to humiliate myself to make it up to you guys. And if you aren't a subscriber, you'll be hearing this too. And I'll be getting a small preview. WeTheFifth.substack.com, and would like to welcome you aboard, and you can help sustain this podcast because, you know, it's important to us, and we would like to keep going doing it. Okay. Oh, and by the way, it was our 8th anniversary yesterday. I'm recording this on Tuesday, April 2nd, April 1st, April Fool's Day was the first episode of this, and I realized that when that was pointed out online, that we recorded our first episode of this show and Barack Obama was still president. Good Lord. It's been a long time. All right. Enjoy. And we'll see you for Andrew Sullivan tomorrow.
We know of new methods of attack.
Why don't we start this?
The Trojan horse. And the fifth column.
About what's going on in the news. I know that you're probably paying pretty close attention to everything. I have been a little less attentive to these things in the past couple of days, but you know, what should we be paying attention to? What should we be talking about?
There's 8 months of this. it's 8 months of this. It's amazing to me that the insanity that is just clearly right here, just right in front. It's the apple that Peter Dinklage is chasing and living from oblivion in a scene that he doesn't want to be in.
Very specific Peter Dinklage reference, by the way.
you have to be, or else he gets really mad at you. speaking of which, I saw the Wonka remake last night. Or not the remake, I saw Wonka. with Timothy Chalamet. Fantastic movie, like weirdly great. I'm unnerved by how good it was. Yes, maybe I'm soft in my middle age, which is not unlikely. But no, it was really good. It was actually just a like kind of steampunky without being irritating and very good. But like they replaced the Oompa Loompa. That's the big question always with these things. It's like, what do we do with the Oompa Loompas? Because in the first movie, everyone always loves the Oompa Loompas, and so that must be a problem because you just got a bunch of guys who are midgets. Well, you see,
do they do it with women of color who are very accomplished?
Well, in Wonka, they actually do it with it wasn't a whole Oompa Loompas; it's just one.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's Hugh Grant.
Oh, really?
It's fantastic. It's, I mean, Hugh Grant is technically imperfect in every single thing.
He literally plays one character.
That's fine.
Wonderful. I'm a small man. You know what I'm saying? Wonderful. Yeah, the amazing thing is
the character gets more rancid
in a movie that I had never seen until recently, which is some kind of classic amongst dumb women. Sorry, I'm not saying women are just certain dumb women that I know love this, and I will tell them to their face that you're an idiot for liking this Love Actually movie. And he plays this like Tony Blair character in it, and I had never seen the movie, and it's really terrible.
And he just does the stammering, like four weddings and a funeral guy.
Yes, I'm a prime minister. Yeah, it's like the debates in Parliament don't sound very good, but. But yeah, so that's a movie that I should see. I don't know. I'm not going to see that movie. But in the world of politics and the world of culture and the world of everything else, what should I be paying attention to that I haven't been paying attention to?
So I don't even know like how I was going to thread Oompa Loompas back to the presidential. I did. But this is the magic of Hugh Grant. He just distracts you. Into some new realm. No, you just expect at some point the weirdness to loop back around in the presidential race and be reflected in something. Mm-hmm. Like right now, the most that you get, and it was pretty good when Nikki Haley lost to Uncommitted. None of the above in Nevada, in the Nevada caucus. That was pretty good. And the Uncommitteds had done all right a little bit in Michigan and elsewhere. There's a dude who won an American Samoa.
Oh yeah,
so
what
that's
was
the
that
closest
name?
That we're going to get. I have no idea. Jason Faulkner or something. He's like a 90s alt rocker from LA. Yeah.
Robert Palmer won.
Yeah, that would be pretty great. I can already picture his cabinet somehow. I don't know why. There otherwise isn't the weirdness. And the weirdness, I think, has to be expressed either in just the crazy shit that is going to happen to Trump, is happening to Trump, and that he is saying and doing, which is ever present. Or it's going to be in third-party stuff, Robert Kennedy in particular. So what I'm paying attention to, No Labels is in it, apparently.
I had a really interesting dinner and drinks the other night, and at some point, a friend of mine was there, I hadn't seen him in a long time, and he is very close with Bobby Jr. I went to his wedding. He went to his wedding.
Yeah?
He's an Irishman. He knows all the Kennedys, and he's part of that kind of universe. And I know him because I edited one of his books a long time ago. He's a very nice guy. And we saw our friend Noam Dorman, who, by the way, my friend who was there, it turned to him, I'd never met him, and he said, you know, you're fast becoming like a folk hero. For like your insane interviews, you own a comedy club.
Totally true.
And you just like every time I turn on like Twitter or whatever, there's like a clip of you just absolutely dismembering somebody. And that was true recently with these two people who own a comedy club in Seattle, who had canceled these guys from the Legion of Skanks, which is Dave Smith and who else was on there? A couple other guys, and they canceled them. And Noam was very nice to them, but absolutely held their feet to the fire as a comedy club owner, as a free speech advocate, and as somebody who is very, very good at debating. And it was fantastic. But so Noam said to me, we should get him on the show. Will you come and join me if I get him on the show? And I said, sure, yeah, if you get him on the show. Because my friend,
there,
his buddy, he's like, yeah, I'll text him and he'll do it. And I feel bad because I've said so many horrible things about him, but I said, yeah, sure. And Noam was like, okay, so tell me what your issues are with him beyond kind of vaccine stuff. And it was like, huh, let me think. And so we went through that. We had a conversation about it. And I think at the end of it, which, you know, I've been so critical of him, and we've been, you and I especially, Camille's been a little more open. And, you know, we had Coleman on the show, and we argued about it with Coleman. And I think at the end of the day, I look at the way he's been treated by media in general. And he said something, I can't remember what show it was. It was the first show he'd been invited on in like 10 years or something. Like some actual cable television show, not a podcast, because his whole kind of idea has been to do this campaign through podcasts, because that's the only people that will have him on. And I think in that sense, about, you know, access to media, I kind of was becoming a little sympathetic to him just on that sense. And just in the sense that, like, I don't like the idea that you cannot host him because he has, because of wrongthink. And if we think that that's okay because of, you know, vaccine stuff, and, you know, whether it's the Andrew Wakefield style vaccine stuff and the, you know, pre-COVID stuff, the argument that people make is that it's dangerous.
Yeah. Right?
Because they'll hear it, and then all of a sudden they'll take their, they won't vaccinate their kids, et cetera, because we don't trust people. Keep in mind that that's the argument that was made about running a Tom Cotton editorial.
Yeah.
Which is like, you're making us unsafe. And then I was like, oh God, he's been like kind of an OG as the unsafe guy. And I don't have any fear of, you know, having a conversation with the guy, debating the guy. I think he's right about a lot of things. I think he's wrong about a ton of things. But, you know, at this point, I don't have a problem talking to him. And I will make very clear that I disagree with him on a bunch of stuff. And I think he is a conspiracist, in the sense, like, he has a conspiratorial mind. It's not a coincidence that he doesn't think his father was killed by Sirhan Sirhan, who was filmed killing him. So, but I also think that's why he's so fanatically pro-Israel, because he actually does know that Sirhan Sirhan, a Palestinian, killed his father for the purpose of, you know, the Palestinian project. I mean, he said Sirhan Sirhan was like, you know, Bobby Kennedy was like jets for Israel. This is 68 and 67 war. He was very supportive of Israel. And Sirhan Sirhan is a Christian. He's not a Muslim, but he's a Palestinian Christian. And I think that secretly, I think he knows that that's what happened. But that conspiratorial stuff drives me crazy with him.
I mean, he gravitates towards there with just about any subject. So if
that's a problem,
if you find yourself irritated by that as a mindset, then he can become irritating pretty quickly.
So let me throw this to everybody there. And you know, at some point we can, Camille's going to hop on in a second and sort this out, but the recording, everything. But throw stuff in the chat or whatever. If you guys, maybe you're fans of him, it doesn't make a difference. I mean, I'm happy that people that listen to us are, and I know that some are, and it doesn't surprise me and it doesn't bother me in any way. But if you are a fan or not a fan, and you were plop down in front of Bobby Kennedy, what would you ask him? What do you think the thing... Look, I'll say this, even if you are a fan. If you're a fan of him, I imagine that you're a critical thinker and you're still a fan of him. What do you think the question that you would put to him that needs to be put to him that would challenge him the most? I mean, I have a series of these, which I think, but I'm interested in what our listeners think too. What would that be for you, Matt?
I mean, I would want him just to defend positions that he has taken that he hasn't talked about. And he did that a little bit with Nick Gillespie when he interviewed him. He channeled some of the stuff that I had written about that would pretty nasty on free speech, which for me is a pretty fundamental level issue of just, you know, do you still believe X? There'd be a lot of those going on. Or like, why is it that you... explain to me the process of why you changed your mind on X. This could be wrong, but I seem to recall that after an entire lifetime of being dead set against nuclear power, for example, which is, you know, has traditionally been an American environmentalist, like, oh yeah, we just all hate nuclear power. That's the way it is.
Yeah.
But over the last 4 or 5 years, that's started to change, right? And the people that Bobby Kennedy's playing footsie with now, they tend to talk about things that he wasn't talking about 5 years ago, like Bitcoin, you know, where he's now a big enthusiast, and nuclear power. And I seem to recall him recently saying, you know, indicating new kind of openness toward it. So just sort of like actually concretely explaining how he changed his mind on certain issues. How did he find that? That's a fundamentally interesting process. I remember seeing.
But, you know, one of those things, just sorry to interject here, but one of those things that I find interesting is that when the clip that you showed, Matt, in the thing that you published at Reason a long time ago, and that Nick asked him about when he was like, you know, climate deniers should go to jail, et cetera.
Get the corporate death penalty.
Death penalty and things like that, is that, you know, these people have views, and by people, you know, they can be Charles Koch. It can be people from the Competitive Enterprise Institute. It can be people who, you know, just write about this stuff and come to different conclusions. That's you on almost everything, right? On vaccines. And you want that for people who don't agree with the scientific consensus on climate change. Square that circle for me. Give me a sense of why one is okay and one isn't. And if you have moved from that position, please tell me, because I'd love to know. And if you have moved, would you sit down with somebody who was, as you say, a climate change denier, and using the phrase that he would use, and have a conversation with him? Because you are desperately asking all of us in the media to come and sit down and have conversations with you, because you are actually saying things that you say are true, but the consensus is, and there has been a kind of hammer lock on what we can talk about, that we can't talk about this stuff, and you're saying we should be able to. Why is that good for you, but not for them?
And he has.
I don't know why no one's asked him that.
I mean, again,
they have.
Nick did a little bit, but there hasn't been a ton of that.
I mean, Nick's a great interviewer, so
there is going to be, just hearing you posit all this, a lot of the media story over the next coming while is going to be versions of this. We already saw it beginning 4 or 5 months ago, where there was a spasm of, you know, the thing that's going to have fascism come back in this country is if these third party candidates run for election and they tip it to Donald Trump. And they're, you know, Bill Clinton has been sort of sent out to kneecap these people at the pass. Yeah. And he successfully has already with Joe Manchin and Larry Hogan, both no labels people. Like, Bill took long walks with them. And after the long walks, they decided that they were going to do the no labels thing. I think no labels is dead in the water. I wrote a piece.
What do you think he said to them? Like, if you don't do, I'm going to fuck your wife. What, I mean, did he have, like, what was the threat?
I mean, you've seen him now. Like, he doesn't have.
I don't think he fucks anything anymore. But he used to.
And, like, he needs a drink of water more than he needs a fucking. But he still has enough pull. I mean, we don't have the, what was the name of the horrible, the Clinton Initiative? What was the?
Clinton Global Initiative.
They were huge. Remember how
lest you think it was only America. Yeah.
It was all over the place. And it was really one of the most like rancid, like influence plays. Like, I have no doubt that the Trump family is absolutely enriching itself as we speak in really unseemly like ways to leverage their post-presidency, particularly in the Middle East and places like that. But look at the Clinton Global Initiative too. I mean, it was just, hey, are you a really, really shitty dictator? Then great, because you're going to pay $15 million to have your reputation laundered and come to our summit meeting in Montana and Bozeman over the summer and talk about why climate change is important or whatever the fuck it is. All of that was sort of a way to keep a power network alive. It was more global than it was local, but like the Clintons were the power brokers in the Democratic Party for a long time. So can just quickly say you will have no future in the Democratic Party.
I think that they still are, in the sense that the AOCs of the world are desperate to dislodge them. There is not enough forward motion. There is, you know, it is in their head. And it's funny because I've been writing something for the past couple of days, and I actually have not come up for air because I've been writing so much about this stuff. And one of the things that I kind of came across that wasn't entirely relevant, but I came across AOC's initial victory. And on the day that she won, I sat down with her. I was with her the day that she won. And I sat down, and the craziest thing is that they cut this as a promo advice when I sat down with her. And she was like, you know, the sexism of this campaign. But keep in mind, this was, she hadn't won one. She won the Democratic primary. And it went against Joe Crowley, right? Who was the incumbent and quite a kingmaker in New York Democratic politics. And I said to her, she said something about, you know, sexism. I mean, this is, you know, not the Trump people. This is amongst Democrats. And I said, you think sexism played a role? And her response was absolutely perfect and told you exactly what was going to come with her. She said, well, duh. Literally said that to me. And that was, they cut that as the promo. And so I was back in that kind of time, and it was like unbelievable, the coverage. Look, there's a lot of fluke elections, you know, low turnout in these kind of it's not even an election, a primary in Queens. It's not, there's not a lot of people going to come out for that. And it was like, that was the harbinger of everything that was to come. And it was incredible to see the media wish casting. It was unbelievable. Like, if you don't think that the media, and I know this from being inside of it for so long, and the way that I was inside of it was not in ideological media. I worked at Reason, that's true. But after that, I worked at Newsweek, The Daily Beast, Vice, you know, wrote for a bunch of places that were not ideological in the sense that, you know, sort of Reason was expressly ideological. And you understand that these people are all, you know, DSA types. They're very, very much on her side. So they give this kind of lopsided coverage. It's not even positive coverage. It's just coverage of this completely inconsequential congresswoman from a district that doesn't really matter and who doesn't pass, you know, any legislation, doesn't do anything. But she is there on Instagram. And they say, well, we're justified because she's young, isn't she? There's a lot of young people that do similar things. But why is she so important? But the desperation to have her, and after that, Ayanna Pressley and Rashida Tlaib. I mentioned that I interviewed Rashida Tlaib, and she was the dumbest, hands down the dumbest person I've ever. I could not believe how stupid she was. And I'm not, this is not because I disagree with her. I have interviewed so many people that I just fundamentally disagree with, and I think they're wrong about everything. But I'm impressed by, and I'm like, yeah, that was interesting. She was a catastrophe. In everything that she said was either untrue or sort of stupidly framed. But the desperation to have them control the Democratic Party is the wish casting that's been going on for 4+ years now. It's like, what influence does the squad have? Well, they have an enormous amount of influence over the media. The party? I mean, good Lord, you saw this with Bernie Sanders in 2016. They was like, oh, the Democratic Party would not allow him. And then you'd have to stop yourself and say, you guys realize he's never identified as a Democratic Party.
Guys.